Right now, Wall Street is aggressively buying into decentralized digital money,
Yeah, they really are.
while at the same time, our highly regulated billion-dollar corporate cloud networks are just, well, they're actively being dismantled by hackers.
Right, using what basically amount to stolen digital hotel key cards.
Exactly. I mean, the infrastructure we historically assume is totally secure is proving remarkably fragile.
It is.
And then the volatile technology we usually view with all the skepticism, that's rapidly becoming the foundation of traditional finance.
It's a really profound paradox, and I think it perfectly illustrates the central theme of the materials we're looking at today.
Yeah.
We're watching this simultaneous stress testing and rebuilding of almost every major system that governs how we operate.
So whether you are winding down for the night or, prepping for an important morning meeting, you are about to get an exclusive synthesized briefing.
A real deep dive.
We've got a stack of six late-night dispatches here from the Tech & Night tech briefing, and we are looking at a huge spectrum of intelligence today.
Oh, absolutely.
We've got Wall Street crypto maneuvers, severe cloud infrastructure breaches, the evolving psychology of gaming, and even a high-stakes orbital rescue mission.
Which, I mean, on paper, those sound like entirely disconnected industries, right?
Yeah, finance, cybersecurity, entertainment, space.
Exactly. But when you look closely at these sources, they are all telling the exact same story.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with what is arguably the most aggressive disruption happening in traditional finance right now.
The Morgan Stanley situation.
Right. Morgan Stanley is making a massive play in the crypto ETF market, and it's basically designed to completely undercut their competitors.
Entirely undercut them.
They just filed amended prospectuses for new Ethereum and Solana ETFs, and they set their annual management fees at an industry low 0.14%.
Which is wild.
It is. For some context, BlackRock sits at 0.25%, and Grayscale's Ethereum Trust has historically hovered around like 2.5%.
So Morgan Stanley is just dropping the floor here.
Dropping it completely. But the fee isn't even the most disruptive part. These new ETFs actually include a built-in staking strategy.
Right. And what's fascinating here is that this is where the paradigm truly shifts for institutional money.
How so?
Well, historically, buying a crypto ETF just meant you were getting price exposure, right? You bought it hoping the price of the asset would go up.
Sure, just like a stock.
Exactly. But staking changes the fundamental nature of the investment. For networks like Ethereum and Solana, staking essentially means taking your digital assets and locking them up to act as a security deposit.
Okay.
By locking up that collateral, you get the right to help the network process and validate incoming transactions. And in exchange for doing that work, the network pays you a fee.
Oh, I see. And Morgan Stanley is partnering with infrastructure providers to do this.
Yeah, companies like Figment, Galaxy Digital, and Coinbase Canada, they're doing exactly this with the ETF's holdings.
So investors aren't just getting price appreciation.
Right, they could see net yields of roughly 3.5% for Ethereum and like 6% for Solana.
But let's look at the mechanics of that security deposit because staking carries what's known as slashing risk,
It
right?
does, yes.
So if Morgan Stanley's partners are acting as validators and say their software glitches, or they accidentally validate a fraudulent transaction,
The network's algorithm catches it.
and it automatically penalizes them, right? It burns a portion of their deposited crypto.
That's the slash, exactly.
So if I'm an investor, isn't this slashing risk kind of like going to a cheap mechanic who might accidentally void your car's warranty?
That's a great way to put it.
Are these yield-bearing ETFs actually safer than just holding the asset offline yourself in a cold wallet?
Well, it's a critical question of trade-offs. I mean, you're absolutely right that algorithmic slashing is a genuine technical risk.
Right.
But for an institutional investor, or even, a retail investor holding this in a tax-advantaged account like an IRA.
Right, something heavily regulated.
Exactly. The ETF structure offers something way more valuable than total control. It offers custodial security and compliance.
Yeah.
Plus, Morgan Stanley is actively mitigating that slashing risk by diversifying the validation duties across multiple top-tier insured providers.
So they're spreading the risk around.
Yeah. Now, the old crypto adage of not your keys, not your coins, that still applies here.
Because you don't actually hold the cryptographic keys.
Right, meaning you can't take this Ethereum and use it to execute a smart contract. But Wall Street doesn't care about using the network.
They just care about the yield.
Exactly, they care about the yield. Morgan Stanley is turning crypto into a total return institutional product.
Oh.
And this aggressive fee compression we're seeing, It perfectly mirrors the mutual fund fee wars of the early 2000s.
Yeah, totally.
Based on these trends, we expect fees to bottom out between like 0.05% and 0.08% by 2028.
That's practically nothing.
It is. And when that infrastructure is fully in place, we're anticipating a $50 to $100 billion institutional influx into these staked products.
It is just fascinating to watch traditional finance build institutional trust around these decentralized systems.
Especially when you contrast it with what's happening elsewhere.
Exactly. Especially when you look at what is happening to the centralized systems we already blindly trust.
Oh, the cloud infrastructure.
Yes.
Yeah.
We trust our corporate cloud infrastructure every single day, yet it's currently just buckling under these very sophisticated threats.
Yeah, the Clue breach is a textbook illustration of this.
It really is. So, for context, a Clue is a highly regarded competitive intelligence platform utilized by major sales and marketing teams.
Big companies rely on them.
Huge companies. And they just suffered a severe breach executed by a hacking collective known as Icarus.
Right.
Icarus operates as a ransomware as a service group, and they deployed this double extortion playbook here.
Which means they didn't just lock up the data.
Right. They actively exfiltrated it so they could threaten to release it publicly if the ransom wasn't paid.
But the true danger is what they specifically targeted.
The OAuth tokens.
Yes. They stole long-lived OAuth tokens. And by acquiring those specific tokens, they gained persistent, ongoing access to the highly sensitive Salesforce environments of Clue's customers.
And the crazy part is, we all interact with OAuth constantly, even if we don't realize it, right?
Oh, every day. Whenever you're on a website and you click, you know, sign in with Google.
Oh, I do that all the time.
Right. Or you authorize a third-party app to connect to your Salesforce CRM, that is the OAuth protocol at work.
Got it.
It generates a digital token that grants access, so you don't have to constantly expose your actual username and password to every single application.
But if the protocol relies on generating these tokens, and those tokens are just sitting on a server waiting to be compromised,
yeah.
I mean, it feels fundamentally flawed.
It's a huge liability.
Right. If OAuth operates on this bearer token model, meaning whoever holds the token gets access, no questions asked, isn't that exactly like a hotel key card?
That's a perfect analogy.
Like, if someone steals my plastic key card out of my pocket, they can walk right into my hotel room, and the door lock doesn't know the difference.
You just reads the card.
Exactly. And assuming the hotel never rotates the locks, that thief just has permanent access. So isn't the whole system fundamentally broken?
Well, that analogy hits the precise architectural weakness. You have to remember, OAuth was primarily designed to make the internet smoother and more interconnected.
It was about convenience.
Right. It wasn't designed to serve as a high-stakes, impenetrable security fortress. It operates on this really optimistic assumption that applications will manage these tokens perfectly.
And rotate them out constantly.
Exactly. But the Icarus breach proves that assumption is a very dangerous liability.
So what's the fix?
The industry is being forced to adopt a zero-trust model. We have to stop trusting the token itself and start verifying the behavior of whoever's holding it.
Wait, how does that actually function on a technical level? Like, how do you verify the behavior if the hacker has the exact correct token?
Yeah, so the structural solution is upgrading to OAuth 2.1 and implementing a mechanism called token binding.
Token binding, okay.
What token binding does is cryptographically tie that access token to the specific physical device or the specific network session that requested it.
Oh, so it binds to your actual laptop or phone.
Exactly. It creates a mathematical handshake with the hardware.
That's really clever.
Right. So, returning to your analogy, if the Icarus group steals your hotel key card and tries to use it, the door lock will check the card, but it will also check the digital signature of the hand holding the card.
Wow.
And if it doesn't recognize your specific hardware, the token is completely useless.
That sounds incredibly secure, but let me guess, nobody is using it.
You nailed it. Right now, token binding adoption is sitting at under 5% globally.
Under 5%? Why?
Because it is incredibly complex to implement across all these disparate cloud networks. It breaks a lot of older integrations.
Oh, that makes sense.
But because these supply chain cloud attacks are causing such sweeping damage, we actually anticipate mandatory regulatory intervention within the next 18 months.
So the government is going to step in.
Regulators are going to force the industry's hand, yes.
Wow.
So if you are listening to this and you have oversight of any corporate systems, the immediate takeaway is to shorten your token expiration windows to 24 hours maximum.
Don't leave those key cards active for months.
Exactly. and enforce multi-factor authentication across every single access point.
It's just wild. We are spending our professional lives reacting to these systemic vulnerabilities, right? Yeah. Desperately trying to maintain control over our corporate environments.
Like exhausting.
It really is. Yeah. And interestingly, that persistent feeling of losing control in the real world seems to be driving a profound behavioral shift in how we spend our leisure time.
Yes. We are currently tracking an absolute renaissance in the simulation and management gaming genre.
Yeah, this is so interesting to me. Sega and Two Point Studios just announced the Two Point Hospital, full health collection.
All right. It's launching on PS5, Xbox Series X and S, and crucially, the completely unannounced Switch 2.
Which is a huge leak in itself.
Oh, absolutely. The intelligence here even includes leaked hardware specifications for the Switch 2.
Yeah, it's supposedly running an NVIDIA Tegra T239 chip.
With 12 gigabytes of RAM.
Right, and pushing performance roughly equivalent to a PS4 Pro.
Which is pretty powerful for a handheld.
It is, because bringing a deep simulation game to a portable console requires a very specific type of processing power.
Because there's so much going on behind the scenes.
Exactly. Unlike, you know, a linear action game, a simulation game requires enormous CPU overhead. The engine has to simultaneously track thousands of intersecting artificial intelligence routines.
Wow, yeah.
It's calculating the pathfinding of every staff member, tracking the individual health metrics of every single patient, and constantly updating the economic budget in real time.
So seeing specs like the Tegra T239 confirms the hardware can finally handle that computational bottleneck on the go. Precisely. And the broader industry data backing this up is staggering. The simulation genre experienced 45% year-over-year growth going into 2025.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The demographics are what make this so intriguing.
The age groups.
Right. The average player driving this growth isn't a teenager. The core demographic is 35 to 42 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, think about the psychological paradox here. We are literally escaping our stressful, spreadsheet-filled office jobs where we just spent 9 hours putting out fires and managing budgets.
And then what do?
We go home, turn on a console, and voluntarily play a game where we manage a highly stressful hospital.
That's amazing.
We're managing staff salaries, optimizing facility layouts, and treating virtual patients suffering from absurd ailments like Mockstar Syndrome, where they believe they're famous musicians.
Or patients who arrive with literal light bulbs for heads.
Exactly. Why is the simulation of work the way we choose to relax from actual work?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it makes complete sense when you look at the neural science of how the brain processes control.
Okay, tell me more.
Well, we are operating in an environment of constant economic unpredictability and technological anxiety, as we just talked about with the cloud hacks.
Right, everything feels out of control.
Plus, the broader gaming landscape is totally saturated with hyper-competitive, high-stress multiplayer shooters.
Which just adds to the stress.
Exactly. So simulation games offer the adult brain something it desperately requires to decompress.
Which is?
The psychological reward of mastery, organization, and control, but completely divorced from real-world consequences.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Right. When you balance the budget of your virtual hospital and you know, cure a ward of light bulb-headed patients, your brain's reward pathways trigger the exact same dopamine release as successfully concluding a complex project at work.
But the crucial difference is the safety net.
Precisely. Mm. If your virtual hospital goes entirely bankrupt due to poor management, nobody loses their actual house.
Right. You just hit restart.
Yeah. It provides therapeutic organization. The humor acts as a release valve, but the core appeal is executing control in an environment where failure carries zero real-world risk.
But the irony is that while audiences are craving these deep, controllable, intricately detailed simulation worlds, the act of engineering them is becoming a financial black hole for the developers.
The costs are just out of control.
Totally. The sheer scale required to build these modern interactive environments is driving development costs to entirely unsustainable levels. And this brings us directly to a radical strategic pivot from Sony.
Yeah, Sony has been forced to publicly clarify their development and platform strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the traditional math of making a video game, it just no longer works.
So on the platform distribution side, their strategy seems clear and logical. Prestige, single-player narrative, titles, games like The Last of Us or God of War will remain exclusive to the PlayStation ecosystem to drive hardware sales.
Which is their bread and butter.
Right. However, their live service ongoing multiplayer games will launch simultaneously on PlayStation and PC.
to ensure they capture the absolute largest possible player base from day one.
Exactly. But the development side is where the true disruption is occurring.
Oh, absolutely.
The current reality of producing a top-tier AAA game involves budgets stretching between $100 and $300 million.
And requiring 4 to 6 years of development time.
It's massive. So to combat this, Sony is heavily investing in generative AI.
Yep.
They are deploying AI models to handle procedural environment generation and to dynamically script dialogue for non-playable background characters.
Basically, they are attempting to engineer an infinite content engine.
To outpace those spiraling financial costs associated with human asset creation?
Exactly.
But if we look at the implications of that, I mean, doesn't this risk turning prestige gaming into the equivalent of fast fashion?
It's a huge risk.
Like, if I am exploring a virtual world and I know that an AI algorithm mathematically generated 60% of the trees, positioned the rocks, and wrote the background chatter of the townsfolk, the environment fundamentally loses its intent.
Oh, the human touch.
Aren't gamers going to reject a soulless product that lacks the intentional artisan touch of a human designer?
That is the exact tension currently fracturing the development community.
I bet.
There is intense skepticism regarding artistic integrity, combined with very valid anxieties about widespread job displacement for junior environment artists and writers.
Sure.
Sony is carefully messaging this by insisting the AI is strictly for, quote, grunt work.
Just automating the boring stuff.
Right, automating the tedious placement of background grass so human developers can focus on bespoke hero content.
Do we buy that?
Well, looking at the broader market, we anticipate a severe bifurcation.
Meaning?
On one end of the spectrum, you're going to have heavily AI-assisted content factories. These studios will churn out expansive, good enough open worlds at an incredibly rapid pace.
Fast food gaming.
Yeah. And on the other end, you will see the rise of smaller artisan studios that explicitly market themselves as 100% human crafted.
Oh, like a marketing badge.
Exactly. It will function similarly to the organic label in the food industry.
Wow, that's a great comparison.
The immense challenge for Sony is maintaining the premium prestige associated with the PlayStation brand, while simultaneously adopting what are essentially industrial-scale algorithmic production methods.
It is a remarkable contrast because you have Sony urgently deploying AI algorithms to flood the zone with infinite procedurally generated content just to keep audiences engaged.
Right.
And at the exact same time, Rockstar Games is proving that the single most lucrative strategy in the entire entertainment industry is providing almost nothing at all.
It's incredible. Rockstar is executing an absolute masterclass in the economics of attention.
We have to look at their marketing rollout for Grand Theft Auto 6.
Okay, yes.
They recently released the official cover art. It features the two main protagonists, Jason and Lucia, standing in a swamp, accompanied by an alligator.
Just standing there.
That is the entirety of the marketing material, yet the internet immediately mobilized to dissect it.
Oh, they tore it apart.
Fans are writing comprehensive essays deconstructing the presence of this single alligator.
It's wild.
The sources highlight theories suggesting it points to a Swamp King cartel antagonist, or that it's a symbolic foreshadowing of Lucia betraying Jason, drawing thematic parallels to the movie Scarface.
From an alligator.
Right. Others argue it is deep environmental storytelling about the game's Everglades setting, while some believe Rockstar is intentionally deploying a thematic red herring just to watch the community spin out.
It is a brilliantly calculated maneuver.
But it is the equivalent of a Michelin star chef placing a single drop of sauce in the center of an empty plate, stepping back, and letting the food critics write a novel about its profound significance.
That's exactly what it is.
And it is working flawlessly for Rockstar. I mean, the game carries an estimated development budget of $500 to $700 million, and financial projections suggest it will gross $1 billion within its first 72 hours on sale.
A billion. In 3 days.
But what is the takeaway here? Can any other studio replicate the strategy of strategic silence? Or does Rockstar simply exist outside the normal laws of marketing?
They are operating under a completely different paradigm. But the underlying mechanic is replicable if you understand why it works.
Okay, why does it work?
Rockstar is employing an anti-marketing strategy. In an attention economy where every other developer is fighting for mindshare with, you know, weekly developer blogs, constant teaser trailers, endless social media updates.
Total noise.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Artificial scarcity becomes an incredibly powerful tool. But that scarcity only works when it is backed by unassailable trust.
And Rockstar has that trust.
Absolutely. They have a track record of delivering titles that consistently score in the high 90s on Metacritic. Because they have spent two decades never missing the mark on quality, they've earned the leverage to stay silent.
So they don't have to shout.
No. Their community doesn't just passively consume marketing. They actively participate in it. They become amateur detectives and generate hundreds of millions of dollars in free advertising.
So the silence is the marketing.
Exactly. The lesson here is that when you are launching what is essentially a service platform projected to generate $15 to $20 billion over the next decade.
Which is just an unfathomable amount of money.
It is. But when those are the stakes, spending $700 million up front and letting ambiguity fuel the hype cycle is sound, calculated economics.
So Rockstar is making a $500 million, highly calculated gamble inside a virtual sandbox.
Right.
But right now, NASA is executing a seemingly impossible engineering timeline in a physical high-stakes sandbox in low Earth orbit.
Yeah. The dispatch regarding the Swift Observatory is perhaps the most urgent and technically demanding scenario in our stack.
It's an immediate crisis. The Swift Space Telescope has been a cornerstone of astrophysics for over 20 years.
A legendary piece of hardware.
Truly. Its primary function is detecting gamma ray bursts, which are the most violent explosions in the universe.
And it's fast.
So fast. Swift is uniquely capable of detecting a burst and autonomously repointing its instruments to observe the event within 90 seconds.
Which is a capability we simply do not have a replacement for right now.
Right. We have no operational replacement. But atmospheric drag is pulling the telescope down, and projections show it will re-enter the atmosphere and burn up by 2027.
So time is running out.
Rapidly.
Yeah.
So NASA has commissioned a private contractor, likely an aerospace firm like Northrop Grumman or Maxar, to build and launch a custom servicing spacecraft to intercept and rescue it.
And this is a fixed price contract, right?
Yes. Set it under $150 million.
Yeah.
And the timeline to engineer, build, and launch this rescue vehicle is exactly 9 months.
Which is unheard of.
Unheard of.
Yeah.
To complicate matters, unlike the Hubble telescope, Swift was never designed for in-orbit servicing. It has no grapple fixtures or docking rings to grab onto.
It is a phenomenal engineering challenge.
So what does this all mean? Catching a non-cooperative tumbling asset in orbit is difficult enough when you have years to plan.
Doing it in under a year requires a total deviation from standard aerospace protocols.
That timeline is what I want to examine. Because we know that traditional bespoke aerospace missions like the OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample return, those often take 7 years just to progress from the initial contract to the launch pad.
Oh, at least.
So trying to engineer a custom spacecraft to intercept a falling, ungrabbable telescope in just 9 months feels physically impossible. It's like trying to change a car's tires while it's speeding down the highway, using parts you bought at a local hardware store.
It's a great analogy.
How is 9 months even physically possible? How do you construct something that complex that quickly without cutting catastrophic engineering corners?
This raises an important question about the shifting nature of the space economy. You achieve it by entirely rethinking the supply chain.
Okay.
You do not design anything from scratch. To meet a 9-month launch window, the contractor is forced to rely on modular, off-the-shelf engineering.
Off-the-shelf spacecraft parts.
Basically, yeah. They have to take existing, space-proven components. You know, propulsion modules, navigation sensors, robotic arms that have already flown on other missions, and rapidly integrate them.
Just plug and play.
Essentially. But the implications of this mission extend far beyond saving one telescope.
Oh, I'm sure.
If this private contractor succeeds in intercepting and boosting Swift on a $150 million budget, it instantly validates a multi-billion dollar commercial market for in-orbit servicing.
Because right now, what happens when a satellite runs out of fuel?
Historically, when a $300 million satellite exhausts its onboard fuel, it simply becomes dead space junk.
Which is such a waste.
A massive waste. Proving we can economically rendezvous, repair, and refuel these assets changes the entire financial model of the space domain.
We stop treating them as disposable.
Exactly. Furthermore, it cements a permanent operational shift for NASA.
Mm.
They're no longer the exclusive architects and builders of the technology. Mm. They are now the customer. They define the objective and rely on the commercial sector to innovate the mechanics of how to achieve it.
It's just wild to look at all these stories together, from Wall Street algorithms aggressively reshaping the definition of digital money to hackers exploiting the invisible trust in our cloud networks.
Right.
From professionals seeking solace in complex virtual hospitals to Sony relying on artificial intelligence to build endless digital environments.
Endless content.
And from Rockstar leveraging a two-decade track record to turn silence into a billion-dollar marketing campaign to NASA trusting the private sector to catch a falling observatory. In every single instance, the underlying infrastructure we rely on is fundamentally changing.
The unifying directive across all these dispatches is clear. Relying on the permanence of legacy systems is a profound vulnerability.
Yeah.
Whether you are managing corporate data, directing development budgets, or tracking assets in orbit, survival in this environment requires the agility to adapt to extreme continuous disruption.
But as we look at how rapidly these systems are evolving, there is a deeper underlying current we need to consider.
Yeah, there is. We spent this briefing analyzing how seamlessly machines, threat actors, and financial algorithms adapt to new paradigms. But it raises a critical question for the future.
What's that?
What if the ultimate bottleneck to this next era of technology isn't a shortage of silicon chips or the constraints of space budgets or the processing power of AI models?
What else could it be?
What if the real immovable bottleneck is simply human psychology and our own inherent inability to mentally keep pace with the accelerating speed of the very systems we are inventing?
That is something to carefully consider as you navigate the changing infrastructure in your own professional landscape today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems around you, and we will catch you next time.